Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
Hello, hi, and welcome. I am your host, Emma Gunnar Wardner, and in my nearly 20-year career as a beauty and health writer, I have interviewed a lot of people. Supermodels, entrepreneurs, authors, celebrities, and doctors. And many of these conversations had a real impact on me, and I'd come away feeling inspired, excited, informed, and really empowered. And at the back of my mind, I'd always think, I wish I could just publish the tape so people could really feel that conversation. Well, on this podcast, you get to feel the conversation. I talk with experts, guests, and a few friends who I hope will inspire, inform, and empower you, and maybe also challenge you, whether you're looking for self-help, self-improvement, beauty advice, health insights, business know-how, or just some good old-fashioned life advice and a bit of a laugh. It's all here. Welcome to the show. Joining me in this episode of the podcast is Dr. Waheed Arian, whose story is, quite honestly, extraordinary. And it would be tempting at this point to perhaps even add unbelievable to its description, because Waheed's journey from war-torn Afghanistan to his life now as a doctor in the UK is an example of focus, perseverance, hope, and inspiration in adversity. Listeners, I read Waheed's book In the Wars and I was honestly and utterly gripped. He was also put on my radar by friend of the podcast, Dr. Rupi Audula, who thought Waheed was exactly the kind of person I would love to speak to, and he wasn't wrong. Born in Afghanistan, Waheed's childhood was spent fleeing from war. He and his family left their home in Kabul to find sanctuary in the refugee camps of Pakistan, narrowly avoiding bombs, bullets, and the Taliban on the way. Waheed's health took a turn for the worse once they reached the camps, and while the entire family had battled malaria, Waheed became very ill with TB. It was a visit, though, to a doctor at this time that was hugely pivotal. He was treated with kindness, care, and compassion, and the doctor, on realising he was a curious and inquisitive child, gifted him with a stethoscope and a textbook. Combined with Waheed returning to full health, this experience cemented the idea that he wanted to be a doctor and share the same kindness, compassion and healing he had felt with others. At the age of 15, Waheed, fearing for his safety, left for the UK, although his passage was not entirely legitimate, and his first experiences on British soil involved the police and a short stay in a detention centre. Undeterred and motivated by the opportunities afforded to him, he began working in shops, selling door to door, but his real goal was education and to become a doctor. What's really stood out for me in this story is, instead of focusing on what he didn't have, which given his circumstances would have been easy, Waheed focused on finding out what he needed. And as you'll hear in our conversation, he reverse engineers his problems. Every roadblock he came up against, he reverse engineered it to find a solution. I'll let him share the details of his story, which he does so well during our conversation, but he has since gone on to found the pioneering charity Arian Teleheal, which works to share medical expertise, healthcare and innovation through a network of volunteers in the UK via smartphone to low-resource countries, and listeners, it is saving lives. Waheed's story is one of ambition, hope, healing past traumas, inspiration, giving, generosity and compassion, and of moving the needle of progress. I can't recommend his book enough. Trust me, if you enjoy this conversation, you'll be gripped by the way Waheed tells his story. And I will, of course, share the link to the book in the show notes. But I am so delighted that he had the time to come on the podcast. So please do join me in welcoming Dr. Waheed Arian onto The Emma Gunn Show. Welcome, a very, very warm welcome to the podcast, Dr. Waheed Arian. How are you?
Thank you so much, Emma Gunn, for very kindly inviting me. I'm very well. How are you doing today?
I'm really well. And I'm also, I've got podcaster nerves because your story is so incredible. And I invited you on the podcast because there is so much inspiration to be taken from your story that I'm so desperate for my listeners to hear it. First of all, say thank you. And also, listeners, I read Waheed's book, In the Wars, and it's an extraordinary tale of, well, Okay, when you wrote it, what was the objective? What were you hoping people would take away from it?
Thank you so much, Emma, for those kind words. I would say that we all have stories to tell, and I hope in some way that my story resonates with your audience to inform them and inspire some who may be going through adversity and difficult times. I think we've all been through difficult times. So that's writing this book is one way for me to heal my own traumas of the past, to recount, process them, and secondly, to hopefully inform the audience as well of what's actually going in conflict zones and in low resource countries, as well as how we can find inspiration sometimes in the deep, in very, very darkest moments of our lives, and also how we can help give. Giving is actually a means that we can, through which we can heal ourselves as well as give to the society.
I think it would be so easy to focus on where you are now, because that's the end of the Hollywood story, not the end of the Hollywood story, but it is something of a Hollywood ending, isn't it? Everything that you've achieved, if you list it out now, it could be so seductive to get caught up in all of that. But where does your story actually begin?
I'm really sorry, Emma. The dog is barking in the background. Are you happy with that?
That's okay. I'll just do a little thing at the top and say there's a little bit of background noise. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, again, that's very kind of you, Emma, to say that. The way I reflect on my life is not to look at the achievements. The way I see it is reflect on how a human being, in this case myself, my family, my siblings, as well as so many other people who are in my position, can actually go find the strength to go through adversity such as war and then come out of it the other end, inspired, not broken, but inspired, and come with their own dreams and then turn those dreams into realities. As human beings, we do have a lot of resources. We do have a lot of inner strength. And I hope through this book, I'm conveying that. So in a way, this is not just my achievements. I hope that many people can look towards it and see that there is always light at the end of the tunnel if we persevere, despite facing adversity over adversity. Secondly, I wouldn't necessarily put my achievements in a huge category somewhere and say like, wow, look at me. I don't think that works that way as human beings. Speaking from a lens of compassion, I think it's actually about giving. Everything else comes secondary. So for me, whether it's the accolades or international recognitions, I would say it's teamwork. There's so many people involved as well. And that's another important factor, is that on my own, I would not have been able to achieve all this. Throughout my life, there have been people who have helped me, who've been kind to me. So that is very important to highlight, that it's on our own, we can't achieve much. And so collectively, we can make an impact in the world. We can give and we can help people. And that's hopefully the message.
Even when I DM'd you on Instagram after I read the book, the first thing you did was deflect the compliment and say, it's not just me, it's so many people. Yeah. My story wouldn't exist without the help and support of so many others.
Well, in a way, I think I would take that compliment. Yes, you're trying to force me to take that compliment. I will take it. Yes, thank you. Yes, there are people who can think in a way that see there's a future, even if it doesn't exist. So I would give that myself as a compliment, is that sometimes I look at things apparently impossible to do, and I turn them in that. I look at it as a challenge for me to tackle it and to see how can I achieve this goal. But that goal has to really resonate with a dream, with a vision. If we don't have that innate fire in us, that inspiration to do something, we will not be able to overcome the many hurdles along the way. So, for example, tackling a huge task, whether it's now the Olympics is ongoing, the whole glory is not just about the medal. I think for a lot of them, there's a lot more to it. If you look into the stories of these Olympic champions, they really have a lot of fire in them to keep going at it day in and out for 4 years, 5 years, until they achieve it. For some people, for 10 years, until they get their dream, that medal. But it's not just about that medal for them. It's a lot more that they overcome their own thoughts, their own feelings, their own pursuing their own dreams. So for me, that's, the idea of, for me to overcome the challenges of war and then to get into Cambridge University, Harvard and Imperial in itself is big achievement. I agree on that, and I'm not deflecting on that. But also when I see it, the bigger thing of helping people globally through our charity, that's something that I couldn't achieve on my own and that I soon realized. So on one hand, I think we need to understand how much we can do on our own and then understand our limitations and then bring in people who can help us. That has been one of the biggest secrets. So for me, one, visualizing something that doesn't exist and foreseeing the future that, yes, we can actually change the future. But on the other hand, finding the right talents as well and bring them on board and inspire them. Then with a combination of using compassion with innovation, we can do a lot.
When I was thinking about having this conversation with you, and listeners will have heard in the introduction, your life began in war and you were very aware of danger that was around you all the time, I guess. And as I was reading the book, if you didn't know the ending, if you didn't know where you are now, I think you would not believe what happens next. Where you, if you're at the beginning of the book, you get halfway through and you would think, I can't believe this. This is absolutely extraordinary. So I was thinking, I'm just going to spend the entire conversation with Wahid saying, but how? And I think one of the most profound things that happened for you, and I wonder if you would agree, is when you were ill and had tuberculosis, and it was the kindness of a doctor that actually shaped you and I guess shaped a big part of the story.
It did. So I'll just explain my background story to your audience here. But before we get to that, is that when I reflect on my life as well, I also ask this question, how? So you're not the only one here. But again, that shows that as human beings, on one hand, we do have a lot of resilience, strength in us. On secondly, life turns out in ways that we might not have imagined for many of us. So I think we need to have faith as well. Faith plays a big part. And thirdly, what exactly you've mentioned is the kindness of people. So we should not underestimate that. So sometimes when people are going through a really adverse situation, they should factor in faith, they should factor in the kindness, and that there will be light at the end of the tunnel. Now, coming to my life story, I was born in 1983 during the Afghan-Soviet conflict in Kabul, Afghanistan, in the capital. I was born into war. I didn't know what the reality was otherwise. Most of my time was spent in the first 5 years hiding from the daily rockets, the bombs and the shellings in cellars with the rest of our family. They were usually helicopter gunships in the sky, tanks outside. And my mother was the only person who was looking after a big family. My father had fled the military service, so he was in hiding in mountains and in a faraway province called Logar. He had to flee because anybody who was serving for the military, they would be sent to the front line, and that would mean a death sentence. So for his own safety, he had to flee. And my mother, she was looking after us with very little resources. In winter, she would go out into marketplaces to find some jackets with holes in them, mismatching clothes to keep us warm from the freezing cold temperatures. And we didn't have much food, very little money that was coming from the shops in front of our house. Apart from that, that was it. But she didn't give up. Despite the difficulties, despite the fact that the husband was away and she was raising us on her own. The only couple of happy memories that I have from the entire 5 years is one day being taken to a park by my mother to give us an ice cream with my cousins. And one other day that was my father in his military uniform before he fled. He kneeled down and he gave me this massive kite, and then he disappeared. So those were the couple of good memories that I have, but the rest of the time it was really traumatic memories. Of course, I don't remember everything, but I do have those patchy memories of trauma. After 5 years, every so often we had to go to Logar province 3 to 4 months to visit my father. He will appear suddenly out of nowhere and we will be absolutely over the moon. So I think that separation from father as well, on a continuous basis, that was really traumatic. We would be there for about 5-10 days and then we would come back to the capital and he would go again into hiding in Logar province. So finally, my parents got to the conclusion that, one, it would be safe for us to leave Afghanistan. Secondly, that we would be together as a family. And the only solution for that was to go to flee to Pakistan as refugees, where millions of other Afghan refugees were fleeing at the time. And when they decided, sadly, the situation was such that we had to go on donkeys and horses take very dangerous route rather than use the normal borders, because the government wouldn't allow normal movement of people in and out of the country into Pakistan. And the routes that my parents took with another 20 families as a big caravan was a very dangerous one. That was the same route used by the guerrilla fighters, Mujahideen, to bring in weapons. So any activity that was seen in broad daylight by the government forces, whether it's helicopters, whether it's jets or the tanks, they would destroy anybody. So hence, we had to do our journey at night on donkeys and horses. I had a white horse that I was very adamant to get on it. The name was Speen. Speen means white in Pashto. I loved that horse. So that was my little tale that traveling from Logar province all the way to Pakistan. And we came under the attack 3 times, which we miraculously survived. The only food we had was oiled bread. And we had to rely on people's kindness again along the way. Random people in villages, they will open the doors early in the morning when it was becoming a bit lighter. And for us to stop traveling, we'll just say, oh, can you please accommodate us? And there were 20 families, you know, with their children, women, men, they would say, no problem. Women in one room, men in another room, children, whichever room, and they would give us whatever they had. So I think that sort of kindness, despite that trauma and everything, really stands out for me as well, that we can find the positives despite those challenges. So that was kind of the first 5 years and a journey to Pakistan. And we did come under the attack 3 times.
And there's a significant story within that. I think it's within those 5 years, is the time that you were vulnerable to an attack and you and your father took shelter in an oven. And it was when you realized, when your father was saying, if I don't make it, you have to take the family. And you realized in that moment, you were second in command and actually there was a heck of a lot of responsibility potentially on your shoulders.
You've absolutely highlighted the pivotal points, absolutely, which I wanted to mention in the book. Yes, the first time we came under the attack was one morning when everybody was tired and it was becoming lighter. So the caravan was stationed under the trees to hide, the women, children, donkeys and horses. I came with my father. I insisted to come with my father to the local village to find somewhere before we bring in everybody else. Midway through going towards the village, we were spotted by a spy plane, and my father knew what was coming. So he took me in his arms. He ran straight towards the village. It was quite a few minutes distance. I had no idea. His heart was pumping. My heart was pumping really hard as well. When he arrived in the village, he was knocking on one door, another door, until he found that one house that was empty. He ran in there. I had no idea what he was frantically looking for. And I saw that there was an oven. He went down into the oven. He grabbed me in his arms and he covered me entirely. Before the jets arrived, he told me that, listen, you know, if we don't make it here, if I die here, this is what you're going to do, is to take your family with you to Kabul, Afghanistan, go to your uncle and ask him to help you there. So you'll be the leader of the family. And before he finished, the bombardment started. The jets, they started hitting us from every direction. I could actually feel the bullets coming onto the ceiling, to the windows, the walls. And the huge missiles were launched at the village as well. It sounded like it lasted for a lifetime. I think it was about 5 minutes or 7 minutes. And after that, the helicopter gunships came as well, and they attacked with their artillery. Miraculously, that's when we survived all that. And when we came out of the oven, my father was really searching to see if I was hurt, and he was crying, completely in a shock as well. I wasn't hurt, he wasn't hurt. We came out and then we marched back towards our families. Along the way, there were two other occasions when we came under the attack as well. But we, again, miraculously survived them before we made it to a refugee camp in Peshawar, Pakistan, where millions of other refugees in various camps were living.
I know we're talking about, we will talk about this encounter that you have with the doctor who was showed you that kindness when you were young. But you talked a little while ago about faith. And I wonder, when you survive something like that, whether you examine, well, was this for a reason? What's that reason? And did it make you think that you had a greater purpose?
That's a really good question, actually. I think in terms of fate, we didn't have a choice. We had to have fate. Secondly, yes, we believed in that there's a day that there will be a day where we'll be safe. I don't think the bigger purpose crossed my mind. And for us, it was surviving one day at a time. And hopefully that's a message if I can give as well to some listeners here. So if they're really going to really, really tough times, it's taking each day as it comes. That's what my parents would used to do. My father, the optimistic in the family. My mother, an amazing woman who had a sixth sense about all the dangers, whereas my father was the one who was also cheerful about things. Like, come on, you know, I've heard this good news. Tomorrow, this is going to happen or that's going to happen. And my mom would just look at him, what are you talking about? You can't you see all the misery that's happening? But now I see that, you know, those small moments, those small positives were actually what kept my dad and mom going. So that actually probably is stemming from fate as well. So for them to believe in that. And I started having that sort of mantra in life as well, to look for the small positives, which I learned from my experiences and from my parents. So when we came to the refugee camp there, again, the conditions were absolutely inhumane. Well, initially, we were safe, but the conditions were inhumane. As a family of 8 to 10, we were living initially in a tent, like so many other families. And soon, most of us suffered from malaria. There are mosquitoes everywhere, and you don't have any means to prevent those mosquitoes attacking you. And they're buzzing the whole night during the day. Oh my God, they're horrendous. And within about 2 to 3 months, I started coughing. And I was coughing so much that I started bringing up a bit of blood as well. And that's when my parents got really worried that it didn't sound like the ordinary cough as a child that we would suffer and you just shrug it off. So they took me to a refugee camp doctor. And when I saw that there was a massive queue to this refugee doctor outside, people with almost nothing. By the time when we made it there, it was, I think, after about a couple of hours, we went into this room, a dark room with one light bulb somewhere in the corner. And this guy sitting behind a little desk with very little there, just a paper. And he had a smile on his face. I was curious, why is this guy smiling? He is in this really hot room, trying to see what people after people, but he still got the smile. So that's when I became curious about medicine. And then when he examined me, he gave my father the bad news that, you know, my condition was too severe for him to treat, and he had to refer me to a specialist in Peshawar City. And my father immediately the next day took me to Peshawar City to find a pulmonologist, a chest specialist. I saw this chest specialist there and he ordered an x-ray. The x-ray, so this chest specialist is sitting in Khyber Bazaar, that's the name of the big buzzing city. It's like one of the shops, you go in there and that's it's written on the back of the door, and he's a chest specialist. And the next door there is x-ray machines. He asked me to get an x-ray. You go in there. I got an x-ray. He took the x-ray and put it against the whiteboard. When he examined me, he weighed me. I'd lost a lot of weight as well. I was just like a walking skeleton. He very kindly asked me to just sit outside, and he was speaking with my dad. I think I was a pretty curious child, so I went in. I tried to listen to what he was going to say to my dad. And he told my dad that I had about 60-70% chance of dying because my tuberculosis was pretty advanced and I was so malnourished that my body wouldn't be able to fight it off. So my father said, just don't tell me numbers. Tell me what to do to save my son. I will do anything. So my father would not take defeat. He would not accept it, you know, despite those figures, despite the fact that he didn't have the means to feed me. He said, I will figure out. And then he told my father, you have to feed him meat, fruit, milk, all the things that we take sometimes for granted here. That's what was missing in the refugee camp. My father said, I'll do it. And he got the medications. We came back to the refugee camp. And that's when their treatment started, both from the nutrition side as well as from the medication side. And we kept going back and forth to this doctor. And that's when I forged friendship with him. Beside my conversation with my parents, my siblings, my very intellectual conversation was with this doctor. So I really was looking forward to seeing him every 2-3 months. I would ask him all sorts of questions, you know, what is this? What is that? How does this work? How does that work? And he saw that, you know, I was curious about medicine. So finally, he, on one of the last visits, he gave me a stethoscope and a black and white textbook. That there were so many pictures in it, and I couldn't read anything in it, but I was so amused by all the pictures, and they became my toys. I had no toys in the refugee camp. They became my toys, and that man became my inspiration, because on one hand I saw the power of healing, that he could heal me. On the other hand, I saw so much suffering. There were families who were actually suffering far more than we did. For example, there were orphans there, you know, without parents. There were people who were disabled because of war. You can imagine, you know, what they were going through. So I saw that, oh my God, you know, this medicine can actually treat people. You can actually do good. You can heal people. So that was me being inspired to do medicine. So we stayed for 3 years and we came to Afghanistan after that.
It's extraordinary because it is that seed of passion that experience really sowed, and you never lost sight of that. I mean, it just seemed to be that once you had had that experience, it was embedded. Wasn't even going to be a question, you were going to become a doctor? Was it that clear?
Well, for me, I think it was gradually that inspiration became bigger and bigger. So we can get inspired, in my view, at various stages of our lives. When from our experiences, interactions with people, when we see inspirational people, we talk with them, they can give us some sort of an idea of what to do, things, especially if we haven't thought about, and it starts burning that fire. But then actually it depends on us as well as the environment. So when we came back to Afghanistan in 1991, the civil war broke out in 1992. And that was again a street by street fight, because of which we had to again hide in cellars from the daily rockets, the bomb. But that inspiration was with me, that I saw that, wow, you know, I can heal people through studying medicine. And I saw the importance of medicine during the civil war as well, on a daily basis, seeing people dying, seeing people being hurt by bombs or illnesses, severe illnesses. But on the other hand, I could see actually people, doctors in hospitals and various places, in clinics, treating people and doing those. So that kind of inspiration became bigger and bigger. And I kept pursuing it more and more. I became inspired by it. Most of the education that happened in the cellars was through self-reading. Whatever books were available outside, and I used to tune in to BBC World Service to learn English. So that's how I learned English a little bit, and I found a window through which I could see the rest of the world. And that gave me escape from war. So for me, when I was tuning in, I was completely zooming into that world where people were having dinner. I have no idea what I was listening to, but I could remember listening people saying like, "Oh, I'm going out with my friends tonight. I'm doing this. I'm meeting for dinner." And sometimes they would even say like, "Oh, I'm gonna wash my dog." And I was like, "Whoa, you're washing your dog? We don't even have water here." So that was something that stuck with me, and I said, "I will ask people, is that true or not? Did you actually wash your dogs?" Because we just simply didn't have water, especially in refugee camps. They would bring in tanks of water every 2 days. You had to fill in your little reservoir of water, and you would just drink from that. That was your clean basis. So that was my escape to an imaginary world. Then I would, before going to bed, I would just also imagine that I will have a nice flat, and that I would be going to school. I'll be driving. Can you imagine? I still can't drive, so that didn't come true. I'll be driving to work, and I'll have this family, and I'll be becoming a doctor. So all that, and that will that way, I would just send myself to sleep. So sometimes actually escaping into an imaginary world works, and that probably was something that I was kept pursuing as well. Subconsciously, despite the war ongoing, despite not knowing what the future would hold. So the Civil War lasted between 92 and 96. And again, there was a lot of internal displacement, and we had to flee from one part of the city to another and from one part of the country to the other, just for safety. And in 96, the Taliban took over, and the conditions became worse, especially the economical condition that the borders were closed, and there were many other problems as well. And because of that, my father had to drive a taxi for 6 months to be able to afford a sacrifice for the entire family. And in 99, I came to I was 15 years old. I came to an age where my life was actually under threat, and there was a risk for me to be taken to the military service. And one morning we woke up, and we found that an entire house was flattened by a rocket, and everybody else had gone and just vanished overnight with it. And so that's when my parents decided that, you know what, yes, we can let go of you now to go and find your own way somewhere, and go to the UK.
And that story in and of itself is completely extraordinary because it wasn't as simple as buying a ticket to the UK. You had to procure passage, and it wasn't legitimate, is probably the sort of fairest way of saying it.
Yes, it
And
was
you
dodgy.
actually, you were told to destroy your passport on the plane. But that, and I won't spoil the book. Please do read the book, listeners, because it's wonderful. But unfortunately, that activity caught the attention, and your first footsteps on British soil were essentially running away from a police officer, having a scuffle, and your first night in the UK was spent in is it Feltham?
Yes, first night
Prison.
was in a prison cell in Heathrow. The next day I was taken to Feltham, so I stayed there in Feltham for about 10 days. Absolutely. So again, my escape from Afghanistan was not straightforward, and that brings me to another very important point, is that refugees, when they flee war, they don't have legal routes. They don't have ways to knock on the embassies, on the door of the embassy, and say, "You know what? Hey, I'm fleeing from war. My life is at risk. Can you give me a visa, or can you take me out?" And that's something, I think, a huge misconception and misinformation that's circulating. People say like, "Oh, why don't you come legally? Why do you cross the channel through these dinghies?" And people wouldn't risk their lives if they don't have if they don't have to. So first of all, they flee war, they flee conflict, and hopefully I have given some context of what the conditions in a conflict zones are like, and what the conditions are like in the refugee camps. Some people might say, "Oh, why don't you stay in refugee camps?" because the conditions are, yes, there are no bombs, but they're absolutely inhumane. And thirdly, when they leave the conflict zone, there are no legal routes. I had to really figure out all this, how to get to get out. Or went from embassy to embassy. There was no route. And the only route that was available was to put $10,000 in the hands of an agent, a travel agent in Pakistan, which was the route that was taken by thousands of other refugees at the time. And they would get you a parcel, which later on I found out to be dodgy. But it worked. And that passport was the means for refugees to flee conflict, to find safety. Not a better life. In the first instance, it's just safety. And that better life was something that obviously everybody wants, a better life, but to get out of conflict. So like one of those refugees, I had to find my way, find an agent, and my father had to sell our house and jewelry, my mom's jewelry as well, to give that money. But initially we were told that was a legitimate way, but people wouldn't know. Yeah, at a time when you're fleeing war, conflict, you will not question people how they're taking you out. As long as they have a track record, which this person had, one of our family friends had been in the UK, and I called him and he said, yeah, this is the guy who took me. And that was my only link in the UK, was this one guy. Which I trusted. So that's why I trusted and my father trusted, and we had no choice but to do that. And when we arrived in the UK, when I arrived in the UK, yes, I was handcuffed. I was sent to prison, and they said that your passport is dodgy. And I did something naughty on the plane as well, which was trying to burn my passport, which I wasn't told that, you shouldn't do that on the plane. Later on, I found that. So I obey the law very well now whenever I'm flying. but that was it in the beginning. So 10 days in Felton, and then after that I was released. They found out that, okay, he's a refugee coming from Afghanistan, he's fled war. They dropped the charges, and that was the beginning of a new life for me, that I sought asylum. I made the application again for the next few years until I got the refugee status. I was living in very uncertain times, because I, at any point, they could detain me, they could send me back to Afghanistan because my application was being processed. So during that time, I was looking, when I came to the UK, sometimes when you talk about starting fresh, yes, I started very fresh with no family support, little formal education, $100 in my pocket. So I received safety. I was very, very happy and very thankful for the British people to give me that. But I also brought a dream with me. A dream to become a doctor. So that was a new beginning. And I looked around, I asked people, hey, how do I become a doctor? So that was the beginning of a journey for me to get an education.
And that's what I find so extraordinary. So this has all happened, listeners, when Wahid's 15 years old. So imagine that, by yourself, one contact in the UK, is that right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Once you're released from that prison, you've got to find your way on public transport, I'm guessing, or on foot, figure out where you're going. And even now, it makes the hairs on the back of my neck go up, because I'm trying to imagine what I was like at 15. And what really strikes me about your story is this having to live under the radar a little bit. This, you were sleeping on people's floors, but the landlord, you didn't want the landlords to know you were there because they'd get charged. So you would leave before the sun came up and go there in the darkness of night. And
hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Sleep on the floor. I mean, when I think about it and think of how you lived, it it feels very stressful, and I feel quite exhausted even just thinking about what you must have had to do. Was it exhausting?
It was exhausting, but on the other hand, you can already see that what I'd left behind, it was, you know, the bombs and everything else. So that's a sort of self-CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, that I adopted, one of my coping mechanisms of how I dealt with stress and the PTSD that I brought in from Afghanistan, post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as anxiety. So one of my coping mechanisms was that to look at the positives and encourage, take encouragement from what I was having rather than not having. So for me, not being attacked, one day I was sitting in a square looking up in the sky, and I was feeling safe for the first time. I could look into the sky without having the fear of a bomb coming at me. And I was just seeing this plane, this clear sky that was just going. That was absolutely magical for me. Like that, there are many other occasions. For example, having access to electricity, clean water, food. Yeah, there are occasions when I used to, I didn't know what I was buying. For example, going to local buy a shop, asking for bread made in France instead of French bread. So there were many other occasions I kept learning all that stuff. But the positives were that I was in a much better position. Although I started to suffer more from the signs of PTSD, for example, standing next to a tube and the sound of the tube that would make me jump. I was clenching my fist really tightly. I wouldn't be able to stand up in classrooms to even answer a question amongst 15 people. So these were kind of the, and then the flashbacks and nightmares and so on. But I thought, wow, that's just normal for people when they leave war zones. But later on, I realized through my medical training that that's actually not normal. That's not normal. But the coping mechanisms helped me. I would recommend people, if they have any of these signs, to seek professional help. I didn't at the time because I didn't know, but my coping mechanism did help. Having faith, looking at the positives, and exercise. Exercise tremendously helped me, and I've kept that with me along the way as well. So I kept going and asking, you know, how do I become a doctor? And they said, why don't you just come on, Wahid, we know your background. You've left Afghanistan, you've left the war-torn country. You hardly have any education. And these were some of the people who knew my background very well. And they said, why don't you just work like the rest of us in a chicken shop and then try to become a taxi driver? And then, you know, maybe you will own a chicken shop one day. So, of course, these are all really hardworking jobs, and I admire hard work. But my vision was not to become a chicken wing specialist. So I wanted to become a doctor. And I said, like, guys, you know, how do I do this? So I didn't get any positive results. So for me, I put it straight up there that, okay, I want to become a doctor. How? Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the next step was I'll go to universities. So I kept going from King's College, I went to Queen Mary, to the admissions office. And I said, how do I become a doctor? That's simple. And they said, okay. They were taken by surprise that somebody is coming and asking about this. Like, oh, which school do you go to? I said, I don't go to school. I said, wow, okay. But they were being polite. They gave me the prospectus and they said, you know, these are our requirements to get into medical school. I said, wow, okay, so you have requirements. They said, yes, we do have requirements. And then I would circle what you require to get in there. So, for example, doing English, chemistry, biology, and a few other subjects in A-level. So that's how I kind of like, that was for me the aim. And how to get to that aim, I just broke it down. Regardless
of just reverse engineered
it. Yes, absolutely. But regardless of what people said to me, you know, don't do this or do that. And that's how I've been doing everything else since then. If I see that I've got an aim, if I want to solve a problem, first of all, I'm not going to go and listen to people's opinions. I will try to work it out myself and ask people for help. Ask people who are the experts, but not people who are not the expert, not their opinions. So I just immediately, you know, the odds are probably millions to one against me there. But for me, that didn't matter. For me, it was like, how could I do it? So that's how I knew that I had to polish on my English. I was coming up with really kind of like weird pronunciations from time to time. I still have it here and there. But then I thought, wow, okay, Wahid, I need to really get up to the mark with my English. I started learning English on my own, the GCSE books. On way to work, I started working on Edgware Road in London as a salesman, also as a kitchen porter and as a cleaner. But on way to work, back from work, and in the evening in London buses, I was self-studying for a year until 2000. 2000, I started going to night college because I still had to work during the day to support myself, my younger brother, and my family back in Afghanistan. But that was it. So for me, pursuing my dream and trying to work it out on my own with it, asking for help here and there, and kept going. I was really much not giving up. I knew the fact that, you know, I had sacrificed so much of my childhood at that time. And I suddenly found all the opportunities that were just in front of me. And I thought, you know, if I don't try, I will not know.
That's what really struck me about this particular period is the focus. Mm. Because it would have been in the book, listeners, when I was reading it, I just thought, how did you maintain that focus? Because you've talked about coming from war, from refugee camps, and suddenly you're in London with the bright lights and chicken shops. I mean, that's, you know, they are great. And all of these wonderful things. And it would have just, there's a part of me that thinks it must be quite tempting to just relax into that and just decompress. But the focus of the fact that you wanted to get your education, and in order to get the education that you wanted, you couldn't do it at one college because you didn't have the credits or the means. So in order to get the qualifications that you wanted, you split your courses across three colleges, which obviously it just made me think there's no scope for can't. It's a case of you reverse engineer it, as you've just explained. And instead of saying, I can't do that, it's three colleges, the commute's going to be awful, you just go, oh yeah, I have to split them across three colleges. Okay, let's do that. There's just no scope for it not being possible.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's something that I would give myself credit for, that is that not giving up. And I hope that your audience, your listeners here, they take that as well. That's so important. The fact that it's during lifetime, it's quite easy sometimes to just throw in the towel. I think sometimes, you know, if we are sick and we need help, we have to throw in the towel. You know, you can't just say like, oh, you know, I've got this cough going on, I'm not going to just give in and something. There are times you definitely need to seek help. But there are times that when you know that you're pursuing a dream, when you know that that dream can lead to something. For me, becoming a doctor meant something. And that's really important to figure out, because that will give you the determination.
Mm.
So if we know that a dream leads, for me, was able being able to support myself, my family, and I knew the hardship they'd been through, and for me that was a big means of a means to support them, and also heal people, because I knew that my parents were suffering at the time. They had to go to Pakistan to get some treatment, and like them, there were so many other families as well. I didn't have such a big vision that one day I will be contributing to saving lives around the globe. It was mainly just my family and a few relatives here and there, and for me to have a better future. So that kept me going at the time. But then we have to also understand that the vision can become bigger and bigger, and that's how we can become more ambitious. Mm. And if that happens, that's magical. And I think that's when we've struck really gold. In a way that our vision, on one hand, becomes very fused with our inspiration. So if we can find that if we have that fire to go after our vision, that's just absolutely lightning. And then you'll figure out ways of how to do it, rather than looking for ways how not to do it. So I hope I've explained that. But there are times, you know, if I'm asked to do something, I will find ways to say no, because I'm just simply not interested. So it's not about, you know, persevering with everything that's irrelevant in our lives. It's just finding two or three things. For example, family. You know, we protect our family. We support our family with our heart and soul. You'll do anything. We will do anything for our family. That's a good example. You know, because they give us everything. That's who we are. Secondly, if we can find what we want to do in our life, to, you know, figure out that vision and passion, and then bringing passion into it, magic happens. So that was it. After about working during the day and studying at nighttime, I managed to get 5 A's and that in ASA levels. And I did 5 because I wanted to make sure that I could compete with the rest who would bring in A stars from GCSE. I didn't have any GCSEs.
When did you set your sights on Cambridge?
My sights were set on Cambridge when I met a guy who was studying at Cambridge University. I was working as a salesman for British Gas. And I went to this guy's house who was our team leader. And there was this guy sitting. He said, oh, I've just came from Cambridge University. He talked about it. And at that time, I had got my AS results. And I said, yeah, I'm doing my AS. I've just got my results. I've got A's in them. I said, wow, so why don't you apply to Cambridge? So I had heard about Cambridge University and I knew the reputation. But I said, oh, no, Cambridge is not for me. I said, well, you've got your A's. Why don't you come with me? I'll show you around. He took me to Cambridge University. I was absolutely blown away. I was blown away when I saw that, you know, the magnitude, the gardens, the beauty, the history. And I saw that there were actually people who were pretty ordinary there. A lot of ordinary people are walking up and down the street. I was like, wow. Yeah, all the history is just living and breathing there. And at that time, I had watched a film called Beautiful Mind. So I was really into academia as well. And I was like, wow. So I immediately became inspired. I became inspired, but I was also wary of the deficiencies in my education in the background. So despite all my optimism, I was still quite hesitant. So I think, Wahid, this might be a little bit too big of a jump for me to do. But then I asked for some help. And actually, I was more inspired to apply when I asked for help at one of the colleges to prepare me, to prepare my application. I asked this guy who was preparing students. He gave me time for half an hour. That was application, UCAS application form and interview. And in that half an hour, he just absolutely said everything negative about why I shouldn't even apply to medicine. You know, I'm not white. I'm a refugee. I don't have GCSEs. You know, I should be lucky to get into any medical school. Forget about Cambridge. You're burning one of UCAS choices. At that time, we only could apply to 4 medical universities at a time. It may still be the rule. So when I left that room, I burst out crying, but I just held myself together. It was at Kingsway College in King's Cross. So I went up and down. I was pacing furiously. And then I said to myself, listen, Wahid, you know, if I've survived the bombs, you know, I've survived the shellings, how could I be fearful of applying to Cambridge University? And how could this guy put me off it? And that was it. I took a doner kebab on my way, came home. And I said, you know what, I'm going to apply to Cambridge University. And I was like, took out my form. I wrote Cambridge right at the top. I said, that's it. I've been challenged now. So that was for me that, you know, I'm going to prove this guy wrong. So I started even preparing on my own to how to do the interview.
Was that the first time somebody had really said to you, not for you, Wahid?
I think probably it's been said many times before, but in my mind, I always blank that. That's the one way is that if there is something negative, somebody says it. If it's constructive, I think that one thing I've developed over the years is that I've become, you know, a lot receptive of what people want to tell me something positive or negative, to do something differently. And I think that's one of the biggest successes, or secrets to our success globally, is that I listen to experts to tell me how to do things. But if I know deep down that something is right to do and I should do it, that's when I would blank people who say, you can't do it. If they can tell me how not to do it and then how to do it, I'll listen. But I am good at blanking people in that sense. So you know what? I'll do it. I'll figure out. So I don't know, actually, throughout life, probably that's been said to me many times before, but I can completely just escape my mind. But that struck with me because that was my dream to do medicine and then apply to Cambridge University. And I did. So even when I went for my Cambridge interview, I had no idea what to expect because a lot of the students were so well prepared. I came into the interview room and I saw that, you know, they were escorted by parents. I didn't even know how to do my tie at the time. So one of the parents came in and helped me with that. But when I went into the interview room, I absolutely put everything on the line there. I put my passion, my determination, and I made it very obvious how much I wanted it. And I think a lot of my question answers that I gave were wrong. But later on, I did find that actually I was in the top five of the applicants in terms of based on my interview performance, because I was thinking a lot on my feet. So it actually worked for me rather than against me not to be too prepared.
That's what really struck me about when you were retelling the interview in the book. It wasn't, you weren't trying to impress them in the sense of you were trying to just answer their questions really well and very thoroughly. It wasn't about showboating. It was just sharing as much of your knowledge as you possibly could. And as you say, thinking on your feet and saying, and if this wouldn't work, maybe we would do this. And it was a very practical, thorough response that you were giving.
It was. I think my knowledge was limited. And I think probably I was at disadvantage in comparison to other students, because I'm sure they were more knowledgeable than me, given the background of education that they had been to school. So at that time, that's the real answer. But I think what worked for me was my life experiences as well. So hopefully there is another lesson, is that when we go through adversities, we do learn a lot of lessons. It makes us grow. And it actually made me become an adult even at that age when I was applying. So I was thinking like an adult. I was thinking like a leader. When they asked me, you know, how would you vaccinate? Well, that was one of the questions. If there is not in the epidemic at that time, it was just like, oh, if there's endemic, how would you do that? So immediately in my mind, I was thinking about the refugee camp. I was thinking about the localities of how to lock down and so on. So even now, it went all through my mind as, you know, to make sure that equally distributed, but the vaccine, and to make sure there's no movement in and out. So all that we're discussing now, I was thinking about it in a scale of a small refugee camp, to make sure that my answers were kind of looking. So that's how I was visualizing those answers. So my life experiences and those adversities did help me. Beside the fact that I brought in a lot of passion to the interview, that to show them that I really wanted it. I really, really wanted to get in. So just let me in. And I would shake their hands at the end. I said, like, I really look forward to hearing from you. I was like, oh my God, look at this weirdo. But it did work. So you have to make it obvious if you want somebody, you want something, and you want to get into somewhere. We have to make it obvious. We have to fight for it, and that was it.
I'm really aware that we've hit 3 o'clock. Do you have to go, or do we have a few more minutes?
No, that's carry on. We'll go a few more minutes.
Oh, lovely. Okay, just tell me if you need to jump off the call, because I'm very aware that your time is very precious.
No, so is your time. Don't worry, Matt. I'm enjoying the talk.
You're saving lives. I'm telling stories.
Telling stories save lives. Trust me. It's the work, international work that we do. It is through communicating. So communication is key.
That's nice. I like that. I do want to fast forward from Cambridge. Mm. I mean, because I could talk to you for a full 8 hours about every single chapter in this book. But let's talk about the fact that you qualified, you became a doctor. Mm. And I guess you could sort of put in a little umbrella term, kind of against all odds, you really made it happen. And was the original intention to then go back and be a doctor in that refugee camp and take the skills that you had learned and take them home, as it were? But at some point you realize that actually you would be better served staying here. Is that right?
Yeah, so when I became a doctor in 2010, after graduating from Cambridge University, I went to Imperial College in London to complete my studies and did a clerkship at Harvard University. So 2010, when I became a doctor, it was an absolutely magical moment for me. Just to achieve that, one of the dreams that I had was to have that stethoscope around my neck, then the question immediately for me was, you know, what do I do now? First of all, I wanted to give back to the community in Britain. So I started serving very proudly in the NHS. And for me, that was a way to repay the kindness that was shown to me. Of course, I had to work, I had to earn. But deep down, I also thought that, okay, this is my way of saving lives here in the UK. But I also immediately turned my attention to giving back in Afghanistan, because I knew that people were suffering at the time. So for me, at that point, the decision, I think, was pretty much made that I had become British as well. So I had my Afghan values. And I think throughout the medical school, I came to a point that I went through an identity crisis. And later on, I managed to fuse the two together that, you know, yes, of course, I'm very proud to call myself Afghan British. So that decision, I think, at that point was made that, yes, I will stay in the UK, but let's see how I can also help Afghanistan. So I kept going back and forth to Afghanistan every 3-4 months during my holidays from work, whilst I was working really hard in the NHS. There's a lot of requirement as well for junior doctors to do with their portfolios, to do research presentations, lectures, and all that to compete. So on one hand, I was doing all that. On the other hand, during holidays, I was going back to help in any way. I would go from hospital to hospital. Again, that was another problem. How do I help? I put a circle around that and I said, okay, go to hospital. Let's see if that works. So I kept going, and my knowledge was again pretty limited as a junior doctor who's just started. I was a baby doctor. With my little knowledge, I actually ended up listening more to doctors on the ground to see what their problems were. I would offer, can I do this? Can I do that? And they said, no, that's fine. But they were happy just for me to be tagging along them, because they felt, wow, there's somebody who's come from the UK. He's living, you know, although he's been through war, but he's living a pretty privileged life, but he's listening to us. And I saw that kindness in their eyes. And that kept rewarding me, that kept giving me more inspiration to keep talking to them. So that's how I networked with various hospitals for the first 4 or 5 years. And whenever I used to come back here to the UK, I would tell my colleagues in the NHS that how things are progressing or not progressing well in Afghanistan. And this is what I found. And a lot of them would say, oh, can we help? And I saw that so many other people were passionate about helping. So that's when I started questioning, can we actually take more volunteers? On my own, I couldn't do much. Could I take more volunteers with me from the UK NHS and take them to Afghanistan? So that was how I approached that problem of lack of expertise on the ground, through taking volunteers. So that solution, number one, didn't work, because whenever I was trying to recruit somebody, at the end, they will say, Wahid, everything sounds fantastic. We would love to help, but how about the bombs? I was like, let me think about that. Okay. I'll come to you about that one.
Well,
so that's something, the politics, the logistics I couldn't solve for about 5 years. Although the government later on, I managed to get to the hierarchy of the government as well, including the Minister of Public Health, including the Minister Advisor to the President. And they said, oh, we can guarantee their safety, we'll provide a safe house. But none of that materialized, because they were fighting fire on a daily basis. It was not their fault. Every day there was a new problem. And I soon realized that this is not working. So hopefully there's another lesson here as well that I learned, is that if you have a problem, you're trying to find a solution, it may take a long time. But that solution, you can iterate, you can edit it later on, as long as you don't lose sight of the problem and the people who are experiencing problem. So that's an innovation trick that usually when something doesn't work, you just iterate the solution rather than completely abandoning the whole problem. In 2015 was when I came across telemedicine, which is basically giving advice online. MSF, Doctors Without Borders, were doing it, and a few other organizations were doing it. I came up north to Liverpool to start my training in radiology, and I saw that they were sharing scans from one hospital to another, And I met up an inspirational doctor who had been working in Africa and was using telemedicine, Dr. Ucas, Elizabeth Ucas. So through those chats, it struck me that why can't we use telemedicine in Afghanistan? And this may be the solution. So then I went back to the Ministry of Public Health and I told him, oh, I've come up with this amazing solution, which is telemedicine, which I didn't have much clue over. and I convinced him to negotiate with me. And they told me like, yeah, okay, we will get these equipments for you, get them ready, because it requires internet connection, it requires monitors on this end. And in the UK, I had no idea what I was going to do. But I knew that in the UK, I had people who would provide support. In Afghanistan, they wanted support. And what was missing was the equipment and telemedicine in between and how to do it. So that was my mission. It didn't, again, after about 6 months, I soon figured out that it's not going to work out. Because, again, the equipment is expensive.
Well, it's even like this call today. So we're all using conferencing software, but you have to log in, you have to use a passcode, you have to set it all up. And I think what's genius about what you've done with Telehill, Ariane Telehill, is all those volunteers who were like, yeah, well, he will help, but what about the bombs? They can just do it via their WhatsApp.
Yeah, so then when nothing worked, then the light bulb moment for me was when I saw that everybody was using smartphone on the ground. Cheap replica phones that were taking better pictures than my smartphone that I took from the UK, and they were using social media, Viber, Skype. And I said, hang on, can we tap into this? So that was a light bulb moment. Then I'll fast forward that became the core means of bringing experts from the UK in contact with medical doctors on the ground in Afghanistan. And through encrypted social media on smartphones is how they communicate with each other. They save lives, they enhance education and promote peace. So that was it. The government allowed us to pilot with 5 hospitals initially. The survey showed that it was saving lives and enhancing education. And then we signed an MOU, Memorandum for Understanding, to expand throughout Afghanistan. In 2017, our charity went on to expand to Syria. And after that, we started developing partnerships with various organizations. BBC did a documentary on our work, which is called Wahid's Wars. It was narrated very kindly by John Simpson, and that was broadcast in the UK and globally. And that's when so many other people came in from various countries in the US, in Canada, Australia. So, oh, we love the idea. We would like to help. So that's how the volunteers started coming in, and I kept talking in various conferences to recruit people. So on one hand, the recruitment was going. On the other hand, partnerships were developing. So now, before the pandemic, we even went to Africa. We have partnership with Health Education England. And recently, throughout the pandemic, we've been helping on the front line, fighting COVID in Afghanistan and Syria, as well as recently with India. In India, we're doing it through a partnership with another organization called BAPIA, which is British Association of Physicians of Indian Origin. And through them, they brought in 650 volunteers of their own. And that brings me to one of the final points that I would like to make, is that partnerships are really key when you're trying to do something, scale a solution globally. We can't do it on our own. We really have to look in a way that how we can fuse, on one hand, use the power of technology, simplicity of technology rather than complexity. But on the other hand, how can we tap into people's compassion? I wouldn't say volunteers. How can you tap into people's compassion? People forget that. It's not, people would not give away their time. We our time is too precious. If we can manage to find a way to get into people's mode of humanity, you can create magic. Whether even it's for business, we do not for nonprofit, but we even if it's recruiting for business, I think it's really important to find people, the right people who actually are, one, interested, and secondly, you can see the real human in them. What do they want to do in their life? Why do they want to come and help you? And that's the first question I ask whoever wants to volunteer for us, or even if they want to raise money or do fundraising. I just ask them that one question, why do you want to do it? And if they give me a good enough reason, I said, yes, please do. You know, some people, they would donate, bring in some donation through their wedding, birthdays, running, or something else. It's fantastic. But they said, oh, we're really inspired by saving lives. That's good enough for me. As long as there are no political agendas, there is no religious agendas or something like that.
I think one thing that you said previously that can be transposed across any kind of dream, not just what you're doing, is the larger the vision, the more inspired you will become. And it does seem from everything that we've discussed, and obviously listeners, we've sort of condensed it down, but at every single juncture, the dream, the fantasy, the imagination, it's been big. There's been no small dream running along here. We're talking about really big goals and really big dreams and really what could sound like far-fetched fantasies, but you've achieved them and you are achieving them.
You're absolutely right. I think the bigger the dream, the more inspiring it can be for us to keep us moving. But it has to start somewhere. It has to start somewhere. And I think starting with small steps is the practical way to achieving them. So if we can take one step at a day, that's good enough. It's about progress. It's about how much we're marching in the right direction. So now I'm talking a little bit more in terms of innovation here. But even if you ask Elon Musk or somebody else, they talk about going to the moon. But in one of his interviews, he clearly says that if I can't do it, I will have moved the needle a little bit more forward. And that's something genius, is that's something that wouldn't let somebody like him or somebody else who's achieved so much or they've achieved so much give up, is because they always don't lose the sight. They said, you know, let's keep moving. And having patience as well. I think it's for some people, they want quick solutions, quick resolutions. On one hand, it's good to be that determined to do something quickly, but it can backfire. You know, if you can't see results, whether it's about nutrition, whether it's about exercise or anything else, it does take a long time, whether it's about business, building it. It does require a lot of patience. But as long as we have that determination combined with the vision and the dream, that can keep us going and find fun ways to deal with it. And I still have fun, you know, being so busy with things. As soon as I get bored doing something, that I actually question it. Do I have to do it? If I'm being bored, am I doing the right thing? Time is too precious and life is too short.
There are just so many lessons to take from you. And I have interviewer's anxiety that this whole time your WhatsApp is pinging and there are scans that need your attention. So I will thank you for your time. And it is honestly, listeners, the book is incredible. And thank you so much for sharing your story and for sharing your insights and for, it is so inspiring to dream big, to keep going, to persevere, to not take no for an answer, to not believe in can't, to see the value in kindness in other people. There are so many rich and wonderful, valuable lessons, Waheed. So thank you so much for sharing them with me and my excellent listeners.
Thank you so much to yourself, to your listeners. Hopefully we'll come back at it in the future. We will tackle probably a smaller section next time. You know, how to do things, maybe mental health or something else. But yes, I hope it's resonated. I hope it's been helpful. And absolutely. So I hope the listeners never give up. I will end on that note.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you found that conversation with Waheed and me useful and inspiring also. If you would like to get in touch with me, email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com or you can DM me on Instagram and Twitter where I'm at Emma Guns. Don't forget, there's also that Facebook group. Join the group by clicking the link in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. And we would love to see you in there. And I would also ask very kindly, if you have the time, if you feel inclined, if you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave me a 5-star review or a thumbs up or a click or whatever it is that your preferred podcast platform allows. It would be so nice to see those reviews and find out what you are thinking. So thank you so much for your time. I will see you on the next one.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.